doesn't have to go in the recording, right? Okay. One is to dedicate the learning. Tonight and tomorrow is the yard site of my father, Reuben Mirchaim Shapsalei, Ralph Raskas, and Tuesday night and Wednesday is my mother's yard site, Chana Bat Harav Tuvia, Annette Geffen Raskas.
One is to dedicate to my stepfather, David Golden Hirsch, David Hirsch, Ben Benjamin Vabela, and whose yard site is last night and today, and my mom, Esther Golden Hirsch, Esther Rachel Bat Sarah Valiu, and her yard site is Thursday night and Friday.
Shamas should have an aliyah. Now, this is the source page that I gave out last week, but I've changed it a little bit. I had a couple of little things, so you can either take a replacement or kind of work with it.
I'd save this for Linda because she was too bad.
So we're in the middle of this sort of introductory conversation.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Middle of this introductory conversation about the mitzvah of Minui Melech. Specifically, we've been looking at the question of, or began to look at the question of whether or not there's a mitzvah to appoint a king, and if there is a mitzvah to appoint a king, how do we understand the conversation back and forth over the request for a king, the anger at the request for a king, the frustration? There seems to be a lot of ambivalence or a lot of various opinions with regards to this question. So we started this discussion last week. I showed you we went through the text in Perek Chet. We also went through the text in chapter 12, I believe, in which Shmuel revisits his anger and frustration over the request for a king, and nonetheless says to them, okay, here's your king, you've got it. Right? So he appoints a king for them. And then, we saw the psukim in Devarim, in which the Torah delineates the command, the instruction to appoint a king, phrased as Som Tasim Alech HaMelech, which typically is translated as you shall surely appoint a king, which imperative. Is a command, an imperative, which is a command. On the other hand, the phraseology, actually that's where our discussion really starts. So let's just do a quick review of those verses. Go back to Devarim Yud Zayin, chapter 17. I believe it's verse 14 and 15. Yes. So the Torah begins, Ki tavo el ha'aretz asher Hashem Elokecha noten lach vivishta v'yashavta ba. When you will come into the land that God will give you, you will conquer it, you will settle therein. V'amarta asim alai melech kochol ha'goyim asher sevivotai. You will say, I or we will appoint a king like all the nations around us. Som tasim alech ha'melech asher yivchar Hashem Elokecha bo. You shall surely, which is how it's typically translated, although some of the translations say you may, which is a problem, but that's part of the issue. Som tasim is a language that normally denotes a command. As a grammatical structure, it normally means something you must do or shall surely do. If your brother is impoverished and comes to you for help, patoach tiftach et yadecha, you will surely open your hand to him. If you come across the mother bird hovering over her nest and you want to take the eggs, shaleach teshalach et ha'em v'eta banim tikachach. You must send away the mother bird. It doesn't say you may send away the mother bird. It says you must. The notion here, however, is complicated because the previous verse says when or if. Again, the ambiguity of the Hebrew phraseology is based on translation. Ve'amarta, you will say, I want to appoint a king, that vav, which is the vav hachibur, Right? That vav, which is the connecting vav, is actually can be translated either as when or if. Right? The letter vav is very complicated because it can mean many different things. So it means if you will say, when you will say, you shall say, I want the king. Som tasim, you may, you shall. Again, this is where the ambiguity begins. Appoint a king whom God shall choose from amongst your brethren. You must appoint a king. You can't appoint a foreigner. And then there are other restrictions related to the conduct of the king and the restrictions on the Malach, which we will talk about, Bezrat Hashem, maybe today, but if not, the next week. But in all cases, this is where the ambiguity begins because of let me rephrase that. Had we not had the story in Sefer Shmuel, had we not had a chapter in Tanakh, three chapters in Tanakh, which raises a question or seems to reflect a kind of anger, both by Shmuel and by God, at the request for a king, I'm not sure we would have found in the commentaries a suggestion that this command is anything other than just what it says, a command to appoint a king. In hindsight, the fact that we have this description in Sefer Shmuel, in which they come and they request a king, and they do so using language that is very similar to the language of the Torah, Simu lanu melech l'shofteinu k'chol ha-goyim, like all the nations, the Navi seems to reflect just that kind of request, and Shmuel gets angry, God gets angry, everybody's getting angry. And so the Mefarshim turn around and say, well, that must mean that we have to reinterpret this story this mitzvah in the Torah in that regard. And so we find exactly that discussion, and this is where we had gone through some of these sources last week and pick up where we left off. We find exactly that debate in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, two opinions as to, in fact, whether or not there is a command or instruction or a option to appoint a king, whether it's imperative or not. Skip the first paragraph. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Shalosh Mitzvot Nitzavu Yisrael B'Knisatan La'aretz La'amid Lahem Melech, etc. According to Rabbi Yehuda, there's a mitzvah when you come into the land of Israel to appoint a king, and other mitzvot as well, to destroy Amalek, build a Beit HaMikdash. Rav Nehorai says no, that this entire description of appointing a king is only in response to the people's request. If they should request it, then you may give it to them, but it's even more so, it's a kind of anticipation of their murmurings, anticipation of their evil, of their request. They're going to want a king, give it to them. With the added addendum of be careful what you wish for. And that's precisely the two opinions in the Gemara and Sanhedrin. You see it again in the Sifrei. We have the same two opinions in more explicit terms we looked at last week. And where we left off was the discussion of the commentaries, I believe. Correct? Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about the Rambam. The Rambam, who is essentially the halachic decider in matters of pretty much anything that's outside of the domain of the Shulchan Aruch, we rely on the Rambam. The Rambam takes a clear position on this debate, where he says, Shalosh mitzvot in source 5, Shalosh mitzvot nitztavu Yisrael b'shat knisatan la'aretz. He quotes the Gemara that says there are three mitzvot that Israel was commanded to do when they entered the land of Israel, including, and the first one being, limnot lehem melech, to appoint a king. How again the Rambam and all of these commentaries will deal with the frustration in our chapter we will address Bezrat Hashem today, but I just want to just start with the review of the various opinions. If you look, and this is where I added a couple of sources to the source page just to kind of give you a sense, every single commentary in Chumash, it's really a very interesting phenomenon, they all jump in on this conversation one way or another to address their interpretation of this mitzvah. Som tasim alecha melech is a medrash called Medrash Tanoim, which again says same idea. Som tasim alecha melech mitzvat asei, v'zui she'amarnu chova v'lo reshut. This is a positive commandment, obligatory, not optional. On the other hand, comes along the Rebbe Ezra, and the Rebbe Ezra says, Som Tasim, one word.
Rishit.
You don't need more than that. It's optional. Why is it optional? Som Tasim is never optional. Here it's optional. Why is it optional? Because it's a conditional statement. It's optional. It's if the request comes in chapter in verse 14, then the response to it is in verse 15. What's not optional? In the end, at the end of the day, you still have to interpret the phrase "Som Tasim, you shall surely appoint." So, what's not optional? What's not optional, according to the Mefarshim, who say that the mitzvah of appointing a king. I'm confusing you. If you hold that the mitzvah of appointing a king is obligatory, then how do you read this phrase? If you hold it's obligatory,
then it's a command.
You shall surely appoint a king.
That
who God will choose,
God will choose.
Right, etc., etc. In other words, put a comma in the sentence.
After Melah.
Right. It's two different issues. Issue number one, you shall appoint a king. Mitzvah. Issue number two,
Asher Yechar
Shem. Who will choose the king? Asher Yechar Shem Elokecha. And those are two different issues. On the other hand, if you hold that the phrase ve'amarta is conditional. If you say you want a king, then, right, if, then, we used to do if-thens in computers, right, if then, then what's the response? Then, som tasim alech ha-melech asher yivchar Hashem. Then, it's not two statements, it's one. If you want a king, then what's obligatory? Not the appointment of a king, but
asking.
No. The one that the king is God, that God chooses.
Right. What's obligatory is the limitation that you can only appoint a king whom God shall choose.
But that's like an oxymoron.
Why?
Sum tasim alech ha-melech, you should appoint yourself a king.
No, no, no. It never says you shall appoint. Halachically, there's a way to understand that phrase, but that's not the issue. Asima alay melech. That's the request. So the verb to appoint a king, or to designate a king, or to accept the authority of a king, is lasim melech. So som tasim melech melech, you want to designate the authority of a king, that's fine. You want to submit yourself to that authority, but only
if it's chosen,
the choice of king whom God will choose. You must surely appoint only a king. In other words, you have to add the word only. You shall appoint only a king whom God shall choose. That's how to read the verse.
Right. But see, you had to add the only.
Okay. Here you have to add the word only, and here you have to deal with Sefer Shmuel.
Those are two.
It's one or the other.
Those are two very different statements.
Correct.
Reading it.
Correct. That's exactly the debate in the Mefarshim. How to read this verse. How to parse the verse. You shall appoint a king, mitzvah. Whom God shall choose, qualification. Or, you shall only appoint a king whom God shall choose, one statement. In which case, there is no mitzvah to appoint a king. There's only a mitzvah that if you're going to appoint a king, it has to be somebody whom God chooses, like shechita. There's no mitzvah to slaughter an animal. If you're going to eat meat, you have to slaughter the animal in the right way.
So in other words, this is reshut, not chavos.
This is reshut.
And that's a chalva.
And that's exactly the debate in the commentaries. How to read this verse, how to parse it, how to break it up, and how to interpret it. And that, and it's a raging debate.
They all get in on it. Ibn Ezra says, Rishud. Rav Yosef B'chor Shor was one of the Rishonim, Rav Ash, one of the Balei HaTosfot. Som tasim alecha melech, zu mitzvah taseh. Positive commandment. Vadai, shetzerich, shehe melech, shelo yasa kol echad, hayashar beina. You have to have a king, otherwise you have anarchy. And if you have each person doing what's right in their own eyes. Which is a direct phrase, quote, paraphrase, from the end of the book of Shoftim. That phrase is precisely how Sefer Shoftim ends. Sefer Shoftim ends because there's no king of Israel. In Israel, every man does what is right in his own eyes. Right? And as much as the complexity of Sefer Shmuel seems to be against the appointment of a king, the ending of Sefer Shoftim virtually demands the appointment of a king. So, in the same way that we almost have two, we have two ways of reading the verses in Chumash, we have two books in Navi that seem to point to very different directions, or at least at this point, to two very different directions. And Sefer Shoftim begs for a king. With all of the destructive forces at the end of the book pointing to the desperate need for a king. And on the other hand, here they come, shortly thereafter, and Shmuel gives it to them between the eyes.
Shmuel will say, look what I did. You don't need a king. You have me.
Well, so what he says, and we'll come back to. I'm holding back from addressing what exactly he says to them, and they say to him, textually, because I first want to address the breadth of the opinions and the complexity of it before we start to kind of sort out the texts. But we will. We will come back to. Two other commentaries that I wanted to share with you. One is the Ramban in source 4. I apologize that I didn't have these translations of these sources handy. So they're kind of translating on the fly, as they say. So again, the Ramban is starting from the question, is this a mandatory command or is this optional? And how we address the texts. So first he starts by saying, Al Da'at Rabotenu, our sages, meaning the Medrash, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, and the Sifrei, interpret the Amarta Asimalai Melech. Let me step back one step. Assuming that this is a mandatory mitzvah, working off the first interpretation, what's the textual problem here? Each one of these interpretations has a textual strength and a textual weakness.
Why did they wait so long?
Why did they wait so long?
I mean,
maybe
they're in the land 400 years.
Let's put both verses on the board. Yeah, Amarta. You will say, I will appoint a king like all the nations. Some tasim alecha melech ashe yivcha. Right, so again, we've interpreted this verse two different ways based on if it's a obligatory mitzvah, then there's two different phrases. There's som tasim, command number one, command number two, Ashe Yivcha, and God will choose. Two different issues. If it's
Rishut,
then I have one statement. Som Tasim, Ashe Yivcha. You may only appoint a king whom God chooses.
If you appoint a king.
Right? If you want a king.
Right.
The strength, the weakness here is that you have to add the word only. The strength is that it deals with a different issue that this side has not yet addressed, which is
what you have a choice whether point or cane.
The conditional statement with which this paragraph begins. Ve'amarta, if or when you will say we want a cane, then somtasim. Why does the Torah, if it's a mitzvah in the Torah, why does the Torah spell it out as waiting until the people request it? Why do I need a request to the people for?
Because most mitzvahs aren't like that.
Most mitzvahs are not like that, right? We don't wait until a child says, I'd like a bris milah, before we give him a bris milah. Right? Now, most mitzvahs aren't optional.
And even and if they're not optional, they're not based on a request. I'd like to keep Shabbos today. Can we keep Shabbos today? Okay, sure. Doesn't quite work that way. So that's the question that Ramban is dealing with. Why does the Torah present the mitzvah of a king conditional upon the request of the people? That's a much bigger question. Because if you hold it in fact
an obligatory mitzvah, this statement, the amarta, the you, when you will say, if you will say, seems to complicate the picture.
And in fact, that's what happens in Sefer Shmuel. Shmuel waits until the people come to him and make that request in virtually the same language as the Torah, and then he gets angry.
These two pasuks are both in Dvarim, right?
They're one next to each other. It's one.
Yeah. So it's all in the same spot.
It's the same parsha. I just showed you. It's Perek Yudalad, Perek Yudalad. One is a response to the other.
Exactly.
If you will say you want a king like all the nations, so it sounds very, it reads very much like an if-then statement.
Right.
Yeah. So it sounds like
because one follows the other.
Right. And that's why, that's the support for the pshat that suggests that it's optional. On the other hand, the halachic position is that it's mandatory, and so we're in this very complex world.
But even if it's only optional, it's there.
There are many mitzvot that are optional. I mean, optional doesn't mean if you want, yes. If you don't want, no. You don't have to. And optional means that if there are circumstances that would require such a mitzvah to be in effect, but not necessarily always. In other words, give me another analogy. Take the concept of, well, let's take the issue of a get. Okay? A writ of divorce. It's a mitzvah in the Torah to give a get. That doesn't mean that there's a mitzvah for every husband to write his wife a get.
It's a
conditional mitzvah. It's a mitzvah that's dependent upon. If a couple are getting divorced, then the mechanism in place would be a mitzvah of a get. Similar to, let's say, the mitzvah of Eshet Yifator, which is a little more of an extreme example. But there are other mitzvot as well that are conditional upon
the mitzvah of Eshet
Yifator? The beginning of Parsha
captive woman,
and how to deal with them. Yeah. It's a little bit more of an extreme example, but there are circumstances where the Torah says, okay, if you set up scenario A, B, and C, here's how you respond to it, here's how you deal with it. But you don't have to get there. So that's what we would call reshut. You want a king? Fine. Here's the circumstance. It's not necessarily ideal. It's not preferable. It's not what we want. But if you insist, here are the parameters and the limitations to such a request. We're not going to say no, but we're going to say yes, but. Not everything, not every request gets a no. That's how the other side of it would perceive it. On the other hand,
it's in motion a whole string of events that are the consequence of having
right.
a king.
So that's the be careful what you wish for issue. Be aware of the law of unintended consequences.
And that's what Shmuel was telling
you. They are intended. I mean, they so end up.
Well, that's the question. Are they
having more mitzvot?
Right. And the powers of the king, are they good for the people? Are they not good for the people? And why do they want them anyway? All of those questions we're going to have to address. But the Ramban is struggling with this question from the other side, which is the position of the Gemara that says that it's obligatory and that in all cases, at some point or another, we're going to have a king because the Torah wants us to have a king. Ramban raises the question of this statement. So let's look at the Ramban inside. Al dat rabotenu, our sages in the Gemara say that this v'amarta, you will say, we want to appoint a king, asim alei melech, kumo v'amor asim alei melech, is also a command. You will say, you must say, we want to appoint a king. Meaning, the Torah, if both statements are mandatory. At some point or another, the people have to want or request a king because it's a mandatory mitzvah to appoint a king, says the Rambam. V'hi mitzvah tasei, she'echayev otanu lemachen, achai yusha v'yeshiva. It's a positive commandment stipulating that after the conquest of the land of Israel and the settling of the land of Israel, we must say we would like a king. Do you follow what's going on? The Ramban is interpreting the opening statement, Marta, you will say, we want to appoint a king, also as obligatory. Not if you will say, but you shall say, you must say, you must make this request, because it's a mitzvah. For example, like the phrase, Kilashon ve'asita ma'akel gagecha, to make a fence around your roof. We had flat roofs as a second story. V'asita ma'akel gagecha, it's not optional, it's not you may, it's you must. V'izkir v'amarta, the pasuk says, in this way you will say, ki mitzvah she'avo lifnei ha'kohanim ha'leviim ve'el ha'shofet v'yomru lehem rutzoneinu she'nasim aleinu melech. The mitzvah is that they have to come to the Kohanim, they have to come to the Shofet, they have to come to the Levim, they have to come to the leadership and make this request. Now, not oblivious to the fact that the Torah presents this V'amarta in a very negative way, because it says, we want a king like all the nations, Kochala Goyim. So addressing the Kochala Goyim issue, Ramban adds the following. Ulefi da'ati od, this too is an allusion to things that will happen in the future. The Ramban often builds into his interpretation of Chumash places the notion that sometimes, whether it be phrases or stories, that are there to allude to us of what's things that are to come.
Foreshadowing.
Shechen haya kishalu lahem et Shaul, because that's exactly what happened when they came to Shaul. They said, "Simulanu melech l'shofteinu kechol ha'goyim." We want a king to judge us like all the nations. And similarly, in Pasuk Chaf, it says there, "Vayinu gam anachnu kechol ha'goyim b'shofteinu malkeinu." We want to be like all the nations, and our king should judge us. Otherwise, it's inexplicable. Why would the Torah have used this language of, quote, you will say, you must surely say, we want a king like all the nations? What do you mean like all the nations? If it's a mitzvah in the Torah, it's a mitzvah in the Torah. You want a king because it's a mitzvah in the Torah. You don't want a king because Ammon has a king, Moab has a king, Tsarist Russia had a king, therefore we want a king, right? That's not why you want a king. You want a king because it's a mitzvah in the Torah to appoint a king. Ve'en Yisrael ru'uyim l'lmod mehem v'lo l'kaneb osei avla. It's not appropriate for Israel to be desirous and envious of the nations around them, especially idolatrous nations. But rather, ze remez l'inyan she'yeh. And that's why the presentation in the Torah is in this kind of language that says, V'amarta, if you will say. It's not really if, it's you must. But the language that's used, it reminds us or foreshadows the language that will be used by Shmuel, by the people later on, and therefore is... used in the Torah itself. That's the Ramban's address to the text issue. There's one problem with this Ramban. And that is... Do you understand what the Ramban is suggesting? Ramban is making a very, very powerful suggestion that the opening statement, V'amarta, simo la'melech, kechol ha'goyim, when you will say... We want a king like all the nations around us. That's a good thing because we want a king. But the language of, like, quote, like all the nations, that's really a foreshadowing of the language that's going to be used later on. It's not really part of the mitzvah of the Torah. What's the problem with that? You know what a self-fulfilling prophecy is?
Yeah.
Okay, so what's the problem?
You know, you set yourself up for something and then it happens.
Right, you set yourself
like
up for failure.
You go skiing, you think you're going to fall. You fall.
Okay, so now it's even worse. Because here the Ramban comes and says, the mistake they're going to make is they're going to make the request because they want to be like all the other nations. So the Torah already put that language into the request in the Chumash in anticipation that that's the reason they're going to make the request. Right. But maybe it's the other way around. Maybe it's because the Torah put the language that's an inappropriate language. It's not a desirable language. It's a language that is critical. Maybe they came and made the request because the Torah says it that way. So it's complicated. So we're still left with a little bit of a mystery. Before I come back to the last piece, we come back to the Sefer Shmuel, I wanted to show you one more source, which is the Menetziv in Source 9. I want to share this with you because it's a little bit veering away. It's a little bit off the trail of where we're going to go, but it's such a powerful piece that you really need to be aware of it. It's one of those sources that's just there. Amarta simalei melech kochol agoyim. Says the Netziv, Ein ha-perush amira kimashmo'o bepeh. The first thing he says is that when the Torah says, Ve'amarta, you will say, we want a king like all the nations, it doesn't mean that you must verbally state this, which is how it ends up happening in Sefer Shmuel. That's not what the Torah's intention was. The Torah's intention was not that there has to be a dialogue. Like the Ramban said, the people have to come to the Kohanim, they have to come to the Levim, they have to come to the Shofet, and they have to make a request for a king. And he says, that's too simplistic. The Torah is not setting up a potential conversation that's going to happen 1,000 years later, or 500 years later. But what is the Torah suggesting? El kilashon mi'amarto ochla basar b'chadomeh. If you want to use an analogy to what's going on, he says, take a look. I'll show you the pasuk. Take a look in Parashat Re'eh. Just a few psukim, a few chapters earlier. Look in chapter 12, verse 20, Perek Yud Bet Pasuk Chaf. Ki archiv Hashem lokecha et gvulcha, kasher dibelach. When, again, this ki doesn't mean if, but when. It doesn't only mean if. Right? When God will expound the boundaries of your land as he has promised he would do. Ve'amarta ochla basar, you will say, I want to eat meat. Ki ta'ave nafshecha l'ochol basar, because your desire to eat meat. B'cholavat nafshecha t'ochol basar, you're allowed to eat meat according to your heart's desire.
That's a non-sequitur, isn't that? What is expanding the land of Israel have to do with eating meat?
Oh, it's very simple. Let's look at the next verse. Ki yirchak mimcha hamakom asher yivchar Hashem Elokecha lasum shmo sham. The place that God has designated to place his name there, namely the Mikdash, is too far from you. Therefore, v'zavachta mibukarcha umitzoncha shenatan Hashem Elokecha lach kasher tzivitichah v'chalta b'sherecha b'cholavat nafshecha. Therefore, you're allowed to slaughter the animals and eat to your heart's content in the gates where you live. In other words, this is, again, a parenthetical comment. but it's related to the grammar. Up until this point, as they lived in the Midbar, if you wanted to eat meat for dinner, you had to bring a korban. There was no such thing as meat, the permissibility of meat, outside of the context of a korban in the Beis HaMikdash, or the Mishkan. If you wanted to eat meat for dinner, you'd have to bring a korban shlamim, and the rest of it you could eat. Part of it went to the Mizbech, and part of it, right, like tithes, right? You can't eat your produce off the land until you give a tithe. You can't eat meat until you give a produce, a portion, both to God and to the Kohanim. It's a korban shlamim. And so in the ideal world, you can't have meat outside of the context of a korban. That you can do when you live in the Mishkan, approximately within walking distance of the Mishkan. You come into the land of Israel. And this chapter comes on the heels of chapter 12, in which the Torah prohibits the establishment of altars outside of the context of the Beit HaMikdash.
Bamot.
So once you prohibit altars outside of the Mishkan, now you have a problem. You're living not in Gilgal or in Shiloh. You're living throughout the land of Israel. You can't run to Yerushalayim every time you want to have meat for dinner. So the Torah creates an allowance for meat that's non-sacrificial meat. We call it chulin, chol. Torah calls it the basar ta'ava, meat out of desire. You want ta'aveh nafshecha, you want to eat meat? Fine, not a problem. Chalavat nafshecha, tochal basar, eat to your heart's content. But there are requirements, there are conditions, it has to be slaughtered properly, and then the blood, it has to be dealt with, etc. And that's what the Torah sets out. These are the laws of shechita, the laws of how to eat chulin. This is Kashrus. Kashrus 101. Well, 201. Right. Now, how does this start? It starts with the phrase, Ve'amarta ochla basar. You will say, I want to eat meat. Torah responds and says,
okay.
Do you have to verbalize that request? Do you actually have to say the words, I want to eat meat, before you're allowed to eat meat?
No.
It's a mindset. It's a recognition that there's a point in time in which, because the boundaries have expanded and the distance to the Beit HaMikdash, there's a mindset happening of you want to be able to eat meat, but you can't go to the Beit HaMikdash, so here's the structure the Torah creates for that. Says the Netziv, that's precisely what's going on in this mitzvah of Minui Melech. The Amarta Asim Alei Melech is not a verbalization, not a dialogue. You don't have to come to the Kohen and say, I want a king, even though that's how it happened. What it means is there's a mindset that is ideally, after you've finished settling the land of Israel, the mindset will be you want to appoint a king. Here's the framework of that mitzvah. So that's the first thing he says, is that it doesn't have to be verbalized. That's his first point. His second point. Achen lefi lashon ze haya b'mashma she'en ze mitzvah b'muchlat limnot melech ele reshut k'mo v'yamarto achla basar. If the analogy is to the permissibility of non-sacrificial meat, the permissibility of non-sacrificial meat, would we put that into the category of an optional mitzvah or mandatory mitzvah?
Optional. I don't have to eat it.
Right. You don't eat meat, don't eat meat. You could be a vegetarian to your heart's content. If you want to eat meat, you have to slaughter it properly. That's what the Parsha says. You want to have a king, you have to appoint a king properly. That's what the Parsha seems to say. So the Nesiv seems to be siding with the position of, or at least at this point, setting up the question about whether the appointment of a king is optional or not. However, he says, "Harayadua b'divrei Chazal, the mitzvah limnot melech." There's a word letter cut off. But we know from the words of Chazal that there is a mitzvah to appoint a melech. V'imken l'maiktiv yamarta. If that's the case, why set it up as conditional upon the people's request? You remember the Netziv lived in the 1800s. This is a perspective in his historical hindsight. It's a very powerful insight. He says the following. He says, Ni'ah, de mishum dahan hagat ha-medina mishtaneh. The nature of government changes. time and place. Im mitneheg al pi dat melucha, or al dat ha'am v'nivcharehem, whether it be by kingship or monarchy, or whether by democracy, whether by appointment of the people and their designees. V'yesh medina she'ena yuchala lizbol dat melucha. There are some nations that do not tolerate monarchy well. The Netziv is writing in Russia in the 1800s. Some nations don't tolerate kingship, monarchy. Whereas, Yesh Medina, Shebalom Melech, Harehi Kesfina Bali Karbanit. On the other hand, there are other nations for whom, if there's no monarchy, it's like a ship without a captain. They need that. They want. They need and they want that monarch. V'davar zeh I efshar la'asot api hechreach mitzvat aseh. You can't force the form of government upon the people. It's a fascinating, and he'll explain why. Sherei binyan hashayach la'anagat haklal, anything related to national governance. You're dealing with lives at stake. You're dealing with putting one's life at risk. Remember that fundamental to any form of government is the power of conscription and the war and the army. You have to put your life on the line for your nation and for your king or your government or your people. And so you can't mandate the form of government against the will of the people. Shidduchem mitzvah to say, pikuach nefesh, overrides any mitzvah to say. Mishum hachi, let's qualify that, but mishum hachi lo afshar letzavot bechlet libnot melech, kol zman shelo ala bahaskamat ha'am lisbol ol melech. You can't mandate the appointment of a king until the people are ready to accept the authority of monarchy. Api shiroim midinot asher sivivotehem mitnagim b'seder yoter nachon. The people may come to the point where they see other nations around them and other forms of government, and they see that that form of government operates well and they like it and they want to mimic it because of its effectiveness. Correct. And he sees it in the positive, not as a negative. Whereas the Ramban saw it as, why on earth would we want to be jealous of nations that are evil and idolatrous? The Ramban, the Netziv, almost it's 1,000 years, is 700 years later, say, wait a second, take a look around the world. Sometimes monarchy works and sometimes monarchy doesn't. It depends on the country. And therefore, the request is one in which the people say, well, you know, which we can choose whatever form of government we feel most appropriate for us. If we feel that the most appropriate form of government for us at any particular time is a melech, then that's demonstrating that we're ready for and we want to have a melech. Aaz mitzvat aseh l'sanhedrin limnot melech. Then it becomes a mitzvat aseh to, in fact, appoint a monarchy. You can't say, as we originally wanted to say, that there's no mitzvah, positive mitzvah at all. The only mitzvah is a limitation of whom you can appoint. Meaning, he's rejecting the interpretation we gave originally, which is to parse the statement with the word only. You must appoint only a king whom God shall choose, which means that there's no mitzvah to appoint a king, only to appoint the designated person whom God will choose. So that's not an acceptable interpretation. Why? And what difference does it make when this request comes? The Torah says, at the beginning of verse 14, when you will come into the land that God will give you, and you will conquer the land, and you will settle therein, and you will save your Amarta Vesim Olam Melech. In other words, there's a time frame to this command. It's a
stipulation.
It's a stipulation. If it's, there's no mitzvah of appointing a king, it's just a response to the people's request in a negative, then why frame it in the context of the conquest of the land of Israel, the settlement of the land of Israel, which are, of course, very positive and very intentional developments. I feel a call to Yerusha, even if it's before they finish conquering the land. They could have made appointed a king. Yeshua was just like a king. Skip it down a few lines. The last word on the line is the acronym Ayin Chaf. Ela al korchenu mitzvayim umikom makom en sanhedrin mitzvinat shiyamua am shirotzin banagat melech. Therefore, his conclusion is that it's a mitzvah, but it's a mitzvah that requires the readiness of the people for a monarchy. You cannot impose it on them. For all the 300 years that we had the Mishkan in Shiloh and the leadership of Shoftim, we didn't have a mitzvah of Melech. Why? Because the people weren't ready for it. The people had to be ready to and want a king in order to mandate a king with the authority of a king. Hence, the end of Sefer Shoftim, which brought the people to a point where they were desperate for the need for a king and the readiness to take on the ills of a monarchy in order to accomplish the advantages of a monarchy. And we will still have to address what those disadvantages and advantages are.
Can't you then say from what Steve is saying, they also have the converse, also the right not to have a to abolish the monarchy?
100%. The Netziv is a remarkable statement, because what he's saying is that the issue isn't whether you have one form of government or another. The Torah doesn't care what kind of government you have. The issue is you can have any kind of government you want,
if the people want it,
as the people, as long as it's A, within the context of the parameters that the Torah sets out for the loyalty to the mitzvot, and to the integrity of Torah. And number two, it has to be in the context of the Navi and the Sanhedrin, etc. And the parameters to how it operates. But ultimately, the form of government that you have is dependent upon what the people are ready for and want. If they want Melech, it shall be Melech. If they want a Shofet, it'll be a Shofet. If they want democracy, it could be democracy. And there are many authorities. Rav Kook writes in a number of places built on two sources. One is this Netziv. The other is a Meiri and Sanhedrin. That that therefore the power of monarchy is not absolute in the sense that once you appoint a king, you're on a one-way street that you can never change. So the power of the king is defined. And if you don't have a king, who maintains those powers? The power of the king essentially is defined. The power of the king is to go to war. That's the main authority of a king, is to protect the safety and security of the people, thereby establishing an army and force conscription and go to war. That's one power of the king. Another power of the king is to appoint taxes. There are a few others. We'll talk about them. Who maintains those powers once the monarchy comes to an end? So Rav Kook writes, it's based on a Meiri, one of the Rishonim says this, that in the absence of a monarchy, the powers of the king come back to the people. And the people can put that power into whomever they choose. And so the Cook wanted to argue that that's an indication that there's a biblical foundation to democracy, because it operates off the same level of power and authority of the kingship, of the monarchy. The powers revert to the people. The people can appoint individuals to represent them in that power. So in historical terms, we had a monarchy for 400 years. Says the Netziv, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It just means people have to be ready for it. When they're ready for it, the mitzvah is in play. So I come back to the question with which we began. If that's the case, let's go back to Perek Chet. What's our issue? If that's the case.
Why is everybody so upset? Right.
So why is everybody so upset? Shmuel is upset. God's upset. Everybody's upset. Right here, I went to great lengths to demonstrate that there is justification to the request for a king. Not only justification, perhaps even a mandate. And when it happens, everybody goes ballistic over it. That's the problem. So I'll share with you what I think is the window to understanding, unlocking the mystery of this parak. And then it'll take us a couple of weeks to work through exactly what that means. Let's go back to source number one, Gemara in Sanhedrin. Tanya, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, third paragraph. Tanya, Rabbi Eliezer Omer. Zkenim shebador kohogen sha'alu. The elders of the generation requested befittingly. Shneamar, tnu lanu melech l'shofteinu. Give us a king to judge us. Aval amei ha'aretz, what are the amei ha'aretz?
The people
in rabbinic language, Amei Haaretz is a derogatory.
Right.
In Tanakh, actually, it's a positive. Amei Haaretz is like the nobility. It's one of those examples we've talked about this before of words that flip between the language of Tanakh and the language of Chazal. Mm. The Amei Haaretz in Tanakh is the nobility. The Amei Haaretz in the time of Chazal were the ignorant masses. Mm. So that's just in terms of language. Right. The masses, Shebahen Kilkulu, they ruined it. As it says, Vayinu gam anachnu kochol hagoyim v'shvatanu malkeinu v'yatza lefaneinu. What's going on here? What did Rabbi Eliezer pick up?
He picked up that second part about kochol
hagoyim. Number one, kochol hagoyim, and number two, very subtle nuance here.
That they didn't want to be in charge of their own lives, or because it's going up over the king's going up before them.
No, even more subtle. Very subtle nuance here in the story. I'll read it again. Tanya Rabbi Eliezer Omer. Skenim shebador kog and shalu. The elders of the generation requested befittingly, as it says. But the people killed Kulu, they ruined it. As it says,
is gam anachnu
kohol
hagoyim.
All of the languages, but the core piece that Rabbi Eliezer picks up on that is unique.
The difference between Melech L'Shaftanu V'Shaftanu Malkeinu, I mean, no.
We'll get to all those things, but they're all secondary. They're all secondary to the core distinction that Rabbi Eliezer picks up.
Between the elders and the blaming the...
That there are two groups here. There's two conversations going on. It's not a conversation between Shmuel and a delegation. There's two groups here that are involved in this conversation, and they're not speaking the same language. The moment Rabbi Eliezer distinguishes between the Zkenim and the Am, everything else falls aside for a second. we need to reread the perek. Because we need to hear the Zkenim, and we need to hear the Am. And then we need to see where Shmuel's reaction comes in. That's the subtlety here. And if you open up that window, suddenly you see that there's completely two different agendas going on. We picked up the problem with this already once before. Because when they came to Shmuel and they said, your sons are corrupt, it didn't go in your way, therefore give us a king, immediately our response was, right, your sons are taking bribes and corrupt, therefore we want a king. And what do we say?
No empathy.
That's not what we said. What did we say?
That maybe Shmuel didn't know what his sons were doing.
What was the conversation? Shmuel, your sons are corrupt. They take bribes. They're not working. Therefore, give us a king give us a king to be our king.
The corruptions of the kids have nothing to do with having a king.
Right. It's a non sequitur. The request has nothing to do with the problem. How is a king going to solve the problem of his sons who are corrupt?
It kind of gives us that foray into the whole request by saying up until then, you know, it's like the adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, now they're saying it's broke.
And how does it fix it? And how does granting complete, absolute, and total power over every aspect of our lives, including money, fix the problem of two judges who happen to have been a little bit more susceptible to bribes than others? You understand the problem. You fix it by throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah.
So
get new judges.
If that's the issue. Right?
Well, because the monarchy is hereditary, this is almost an argument against monarchy. Because the sons were no good.
That's right. And therefore, it'll get even worse.
Yeah,
I mean, and we know it will get worse.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
It does get worse.
So that's exactly where already you see that the solution and the identification of the problem are in two different domains. Mm-hmm. So as we begin to reread the parak, suddenly we'll hear what Chazal picked up, which is that there's two conversations going on. And we need to isolate them. And once you isolate them already, then maybe you can begin to put some context.
It's kind of a stretch of a read of it, isn't it?
Well, let's see. Let's go back to Pasuk Dalet. Vayitkabtzu kol ziknei Yisrael el Shmuel haramata. Mayavo el Shmuel haramata. So first of all, Parakhet Pasuk Dalet, verse 4. Back to Shmuel. Vayitkabtzu kol ziknei Yisrael Mayavo el Shmuel haramata. People come to the elders come to Shmuel. So when Rabbi Eliezer talks about the Zkenim,
yeah.
He's picking up on this word. It says, "Vayikabtzu kol ziknei Yisrael." The elders came to Shmuel, and they said, "Vayamur lav." Who are the elders? First of all, let's just start for a second. Who are the elders? What are elders? So, elders can be older people, but in Tanakh, the zkenim usually means
the leaders,
the zkenim, or the members of the Sanhedrin, or the members of the judge, right? Other judges, other people who are leaders in different communities. But the word zaken in Chumash is almost analogous to the word shofet. Moshe is to gather together 70 people, miziknei Yisrael. The zakenim go with Moshe to Paro. And that's what the ziknei Yisrael are the leaders of the community. And they come to Shmuel and they say, v'imruelav, hinei ata zakanta. And there's the pun, there's the play on the word. And you have become old. Your sons have not walked in your footsteps. Ata simulanu melech leshofteinu kechol hagoyim. Therefore, give us a king to judge us like all the nations.
So that seems to go opposite.
Yeah.
So before I get to we haven't gotten to the request of the people yet, but just on that level alone, what's the problem and what's the solution. Whether it's a good solution, a great solution, ideal solution, or a terrible solution. What's the problem and what's the solution?
Problem is the corruption of the sons.
Problem is the corruption of the sons. The problem is that you've placed the judges in such a position that they are susceptible to bribes or to the power of persuasion of money. Okay. There's a problem in the process of democracy in that if you place the position of the judge in a judicial context, there's a reason why Supreme Court judges are a lifetime appointment. Why are Supreme Court judges a lifetime appointment?
Well,
federal judges are a lifetime appointment. Why?
So they can't be removed for bribery.
So they don't have to run for election.
Right.
Exactly. So they don't have to run for election. In halachic terms, for generations, judges were never allowed to be paid. For generations, in halachic terms, they weren't allowed to be paid, period. Right? How do they sustain themselves? So it was a problem. And so they established a salary scale system time of Chazal. But ideally, you don't want a situation where the litigants, because what was going on? The litigants would come and they would pay the judges. Right? The litigants are paying for the bezdin, and then it's right, whoever pays more. Right? It's called dalim gvar. There's a problem putting the process of the appointment of judges into a popularity context. Because whoever's more popular will be susceptible to the sway of power or the sway of the position. And that's not good. Therefore, said the Zkenim, they came up with a better solution. They looked around, as the Netziv says, at other places, Kolagoyim, and they found that other judges, right, other leaders, didn't have this problem. Why? Because if they were in the position where it was hereditary, they wouldn't be, or lifetime appointments in a sense, and they wouldn't be susceptible to the sway of the people. They wouldn't be necessarily, you couldn't buy it. You couldn't buy them, because they didn't have to run for re-election, and they didn't have to run for or get their money from the people.
So how did the sons get corrupted?
The sons were corrupt. They were bad people, but
they needed the money, right?
But and the fact that people were paying them for their judgments meant that they were it would became a simple option. Right. Whereas you create a system of a malchus where they're financially independent of the people, and their financial sources are overall from the taxes of the people, and you don't have to worry about it. At least on some level, from their perspective, may not mean a great solution, but at least on some level, it was a solution that they could live with. However, the problem is that Vayera davar b'nei Shmuel kasher amru tnu lanu melech l'shofteinu v'yitpalel Shmuel el Hashem. What's bothering Shmuel? Does it bother Shmuel that they said Kechol HaGoyim that they wanted to be like other nations? Like everybody picks up on that. Oh, terrible that they wanted to be like other nations. Does that bother Shmuel? Right? It says he was bothered by the fact that they said we want a melech l'shofteinu, we want a king to judge us.
Rejection of Shmuel.
He saw it as a rejection of Shmuel, which is in a sense correct. The request was legitimate. The concern was legitimate. Their approach and the solution may have even been legitimate. But they're deposing Shmuel, not their sons. Remember, they've come to Shmuel. How did they start? Hineta Zakanta. Shmuel, out of the way. We need to replace you because your sons are corrupt. What am I, chopped liver?
They also.
This has nothing to do with Kechol HaGoyim. This has to do with the fact that they've come to Shmuel a generation too early. You want to wait till Shmuel's gone and the sons are not the right choice and then go to the Navi and say, we want a king. That's one thing. You would depose Shmuel after everything he's done for you because you're potentially looking at what his sons are going to do. Right? That's complicated.
And why would they think, though, it would be hereditary with Shmuel?
Why did Shmuel think? Shmuel appointed his sons.
I understand that, but why did the Zakanim think that the sons would after Shmuel died would be in charge?
Well, Shmuel appointed them.
Yeah, but
Shmuel had appointed them. It's already a precedent. It's dangerous.
But
Shmuel had appointed them as.
Would the only, so to assume that they were the only then Shoftim?
No, but I think he was afraid of. They were concerned about succession, and Shmuel had appointed them.
They could have said, you know, depose your sons and get us new Shoftim.
Right. Now look at the next pasuk. We have to conclude, but let me look at the next pasuk. Vayomer Hashem el Shmuel. What does God say to Shmuel? Shma b'kol ha'am. Shma b'kol ha'am. Shmuel. Shmuel was very angry that he thought this was against, was about him. So God comes and he says, Shmuel, I got news for you. You're picking the wrong battle. Shma b'kol ha'am. You're talking to the Zganim.
Yeah,
walk over to the window and look down at the rally down below on the street and listen to what they're saying. And then you'll realize they're not rejecting you. Listen to everything the people are saying. Then you'll realize that this isn't about Zakenim, and it's not about corruption, and it's not about bribery, and it's not about the. This is about rebellion. How? Take a look, and I'll conclude with this. Just take a look one line down. Shmuel goes, and this is all the powers of the king. Take a look in Pasuk. Yud Tet, the end of the parak. Vayima'anu ha'am lishmua b'kol Shmuel. The people refused to listen to Shmuel. Vayamru, they said, after everything that Shmuel describes about conscription and about forced drafts and taxes, lo, ki melech yaleinu, we want a king over us. Vayayinu gam anachnu k'chol ha'goyim. We want to be like all the nations. This Canaan said, we want a king to judge us so that the system of judgment and judicial process should be fair like it is in other nations. What do the people say? We want to be like other nations. The people aren't concerned about Mishpat, and they're not concerned about corruption, and they're not concerned about the Zkenim, and they're not concerned about the Sanhedrin. They have one thing on their mind. They want a king, and they want to have an army.
They want to fight.
They want an army. And for an army, you need a king. And the big difference between what the people are saying and what the Zkenim are saying is the Zkenim are talking one language. They're talking about a Shofet, they're talking about judgment, they're talking about judicial process. And the people, they want an army. And we are in two different worlds. And that's where the problem begins. So that's what Rebbe Eliezer picks up on, and that, Bezat Hashem, we will continue with next week.